You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners.
Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, the only Land Rover podcast on the planet. This is show number 45 for December 2016. Wherever you are and wherever your persuasion is, we wish you a warm and heartfelt happy holidays to you and your Land Rover. This is a podcast by, for, and about Land Rover owners. Visit our website, centersteer.com, that's in the British spelling, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to stories we discussed today and also in past shows. We're part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and I invite you to check out the other 4x4 related shows at 4x4radionetwork.com. Thanks for your comments, follows, likes on Facebook, Twitter, and emails. Special thanks to our Patreon subscribers. We now have two stickers available. I was able to get these small ones at a cheap price, and they're like window clings. So if you're a Patreon subscriber and you would like one of those, let me know. If you're not, go ahead and check out Patreon at patreon.com/centersteer for details. And you can even make a monthly contribution to help out the show. I am your host, John Costage, here in southwestern Pennsylvania. It is December 18th, and it was bitterly cold the last few days, and it had snowed. I always like to tell you about the weather. I don't know why. It's my thing. Joining me, also from western Pennsylvania, via Skype this month is...
I'm still Harold, and I'm still addicted to Rovers.
joining us from the great state of Texas,
Laura Shacklett.
You are with Texas Rovers, and you're going to tell us all about Scar.
Yes,
which sounds very much like a Doctor Who thing, but that's it's another. Every time I hear Scar, I think Doctor Who.
You think of a Band-Aid. That was actually one of the Scar shirts with the Band-Aid on it.
Oh, there we go. And joining us from the other great state of Maine.
Yeah, I'm Jeff Aronson.
And you are the...
And I am stranded on the mainland of the state of Maine because my ferries are not running today due to high winds. So I have to get 15 more miles across the bay, and I hope to be home tomorrow.
The question is, when you get home, Jeff, tomorrow, because of the winds, will your front door be open?
Oh. That is a very good question. The likelihood is that it has blown open given the direction of the winds. Right?
Oh.
Don't you have somebody on the island that can check on your house?
Yes, and there are people who do as a courtesy.
Oh, good.
What I don't know is whether anybody put two and two together that if the boats aren't running, I could not actually make it home today.
Jeff is the editor of Rovers Magazine. I suggest you check out. It's a free copy. You can get Rovers Magazine for free in North America, and it's also available online in a PDF version. Did I get that right, Jeff?
You did indeed. RoversMagazine.com. If you've never received the magazine before, it's a customer service of Rovers North.
And kind of on a serious note, our regular contributor and friend Dave Carroll, he broke his leg, we talked about last month, and since then he was diagnosed with cancer. So our thoughts and support go out to him and his family. All right, let's start the show off with the news. First up is sales for Land Rover here in the great Republic of the United States of America. For November of 2016, JLR sales were up 19%, and in particular, the Jag XK... No, not XK, excuse me. I have XK. I always, every time I think of Jaguar, I think of XK. The XE Sports Sedan and the F-Pace, Harold's favorite Jaguar, were up 217% for November. Land Rover U.S. sales hit the second highest November total ever, and the Range Rover Sport had its best November sales, also up 6%. Things looking good for Land Rover and Jaguar.
It's still the biggest issue for the dealer network, which is that they can't necessarily get as many vehicles into each dealership as they would like.
I guess it's a good problem to have, right?
It is a good problem to have, but it is not a common one that many dealers have had to deal with. Hmm. So it causes its own levels of discomfort. For those who operate a dealership, everyone knows that the service departments are major profit centers for dealerships. And one of the dilemmas they face is if you don't have very many vehicles, then you actually don't have that many vehicles to service, which means your service department can't necessarily meet of all of its goals. It's a challenge.
Yeah,
I think it's also frustrating to sit there knowing you could be making more money if you had more product to sell.
Exactly. And yes, and having a larger customer base, which you don't have when you don't have that many vehicles.
Right.
Well, it's certainly good. I was heartened to see Jaguar kind of rebounding a little bit. I know there's controversy about Jaguar having an SUV, but it seems necessary these days, and it's money coming into that particular model brand, and that's good for Jaguar, so that's good. Even though I'm with Harold, I'm not excited that they came out with an SUV, but, you know, Bentley's coming out with one, Porsche came out with one, so... But, you know, Jag's still on the map. That's good. Better than Pontiac and Oldsmobile, which no longer exists.
That you no longer see.
And Hummer, ironically.
Oh, that's true. Good call. Good call. Yeah, we just Harold and I watched a little bit of Wheeler Dealers, and they did the Hummer, and we brought that up. Yeah, that's right. All right. Next in the news, the Range Rover Sport Coupe. Saying that in, I guess, the – is that the European way of saying coupe?
Actually, the European way would be Sports Coupe.
was spotted in Germany. I think it's Germany, or is that Sweden? It's tough to tell the language, but there's a video. We'll have it available for you on the website. You can watch the 2017-2018 Sport Coupe in its, Harold likes to call it, its urban camo.
Right. Development camo.
A development camo. It's actually this one I particularly like, by the way. This was a really good one, Harold. It looks like eyes. There's a bunch of...
The swarm of raccoons has returned.
And it's really all there is. You can see the car you know, with its camo. It's kind of tough to tell the real shape of it and everything because they do that on purpose. But so apparently there is a Sport Coupe coming, a two-door Range Rover.
But it tells you the popularity of the Range Rover Sport and that Land Rover... felt compelled to offer another model of that model name. So the Sport model carries a cachet. It is a sales success in the U.S. market particularly, so that it makes sense that you would expand that portion of the family, that branch of the family, for another option. Just as look back to Mini 10 years ago, starting with one Mini version and then expanding outward so that the dealer network had more things to sell. Makes sense.
Or a little closer to home in the tradition, the original Range Rover Classic was a two-door, and then they expanded and added the four-door.
And that was largely for this market. There was, remember, the factory four-door did not come out until it was determined that it would sell it in the U.S.
Right.
Next in the news, Land Rover wins high court ruling to protect Defender name. Now, this only applies to Europe, but there's a Canadian manufacturer that has an off-road buggy, and they were applying for a patent in the U.S. Copyright. Yeah, for the name Defender, and they lost that. Lost is a strong word. I guess there was a consent decree between the two, and so this manufacturer, which is Bombardier Recreational Products, they will abandon the use of the name Defender. So Land Rover is, I guess, obviously it's an important name to them, as we all know, and they're kind of holding that.
They are staunchly defending the Defender name.
Oh, you were waiting to say that, weren't you? How long did you? You were, yeah.
A couple seconds,
all right. JLR factory could be built on Coventry Airport runway. That doesn't seem like that's all that interesting, except when you read the story. JLR's chief executive, Ralph Spaeth, announced last week he wants to build an electric battery manufacturing plant in Coventry. So that's the important takeaway from this story as well. Yeah, they're building on this former runway, but it looks like JLR wants to build an electric battery manufacturing plant.
And if they're building a plant to make batteries, you know they're going to get into electric vehicles in a big way.
Yep. And also in manufacturing news for Land Rover, they're going to build the new Discovery in Solihull and Slovakia. So they have announced that they are going to build a new Disco in both locations. They built that new plant in Slovakia. And so there'll be this twin track production approach, as they call it, because of the strong demand. And I suspect probably concerns about the Brexit. I suspect that's probably aspects of that.
And that's interesting because the status of the Slovakia plant, I was going to say the status of the Slovakia plant has been, I think, in question since the Brexit thing first started. So this at least tells you they're still headed with it.
Right. It was its intent was for Jaguar initially.
Yeah,
but it makes sense in many ways, particularly if the Russian marketplace grows. You now have eased some of the delivery issues if the Russian market recaptures its growth spurt that it had for Land Rover.
And then you probably saw this in the news because it was as an ad. They took the Range Rover Sport to the slopes and went down, I guess, in Switzerland on the – I'm not going to say the word because it sounds like I could swear. But it was the world-famous Inferno downhill ski race in a mountain village of Mern, Switzerland. And so they took a Range Rover. It was a Sport, right? Yeah, a Range Rover Sport, and they drove it down there and turned it into an ad. Kind of interesting.
I saw that. It's a sexy ad.
It is. The beauty of it is that you have this vehicle that the majority of ownership does not necessarily associate with off-roading. It associates it with standing, with status. Its premium approach, its roadability, carrying capacity, and the like. But then you absolutely demonstrate it in the slickest way imaginable as a hugely capable vehicle off-road.
Well, it certainly goes to Land Rover's marketing, which I think has always been very top-notch and kind of, I guess, continues in that path of showing off a vehicle's capabilities. You don't see a mini clubman doing that.
You don't see a fashion model competing in the UFC octagon very often either.
JLR won't buy Silverstone Raceway as previously planned. So it'd been talked about for a while. They were going to purchase the historic Silverstone Raceway, but that is now out and not going to happen.
I hope somebody buys it. It'd be a shame to see that go.
Yes, I agree. It would be terrible. I can understand fully why it would just be quite a diversion of corporate money from the Tata Group too to invest in that. It's a side issue
for
both manufacturers right now.
Yeah, it would be a big expense and maybe not give them the best benefit.
Well, wasn't there some thought that the Jaguar was going to get back into some racing aspects and this was part of that strategy, or am I confusing things?
Well, I think that Jaguar might well get back into promoting its product that manner, but owning a racetrack, particularly a small historic one, doesn't do that.
And our final story this month comes from Alloy and Grit. This is the secret to Land Rover's explosive growth and why the next Defender won't please everyone. They interviewed Kim McCullough. She's Jaguar Land Rover North America's Vice President of Marketing. And so they talked to her and had some questions. And so I thought it was an interesting story to bring up and see what her take was. Of course, my favorite part of this, I think it's very interesting, is they have a picture of her in front of her Series 1. It's been completely restored, so it's nice to see, as we've heard many times, that executives at Land Rover, they have their own heritage trucks, and they continue to use them, and at least they own them, which is, I think, a good thing.
Right.
That was a good takeaway, I thought, from that story.
Although, if there was mud on it, then we'd know that she actually uses it.
No, I agree with Harold. I mean, a lot of people around here, they just use it as a soccer mom car. So that's why I was laughing what Harold was saying.
Right, and the interesting word she picks up, and we have seen this before, is she mentions about being a premium utility market is what Land Rover's looking at. She says that folks, the buyers do like the history, of Land Rover. I'm not so sure that they are always aware of it, because as I drive down the road in my Series 3 109 and I wave at a Disco or I wave at a Rangy, they certainly have no clue what I'm driving or why I'm even waving if they notice me. But
And I think that's perhaps part of why we do this podcast, to raise awareness of the history of Land Rover.
Right. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, certainly. I would agree with that. She kept using an interesting word, phrase that I hadn't seen before, but was the, I kind of like actually, was the off tarmac aspect of it. And this article goes on, an interview with her goes on to explain that they do want to keep the, not only the tarmac capabilities, but the off tarmac capabilities, and translate that, of course, throughout the brand, including the upcoming Defender, which she talks about, coming up, and sounds like it's going to continue the way they see it continuing, as having the capabilities and being able to go off tarmac. But she does say, probably there's definitely, as we've said, there's definitely people not going to like the new Defender, and I think sounds like they're prepared for that.
Yeah, that kind of,
John. One of the questions we have to ask ourselves as Land Rover enthusiasts is, what did we do when Land Rover brought the Defender 110 and the Defender 90 here? Not what have we done since they stopped bringing them in, but what did we do during those sales years? They brought in just over 500 110s, right? And they brought in about 1,500 90s per year for those few years. And they sat on dealer lots. They didn't sell. Now, they didn't sell to me or perhaps to those of us on the podcast because they were fairly expensive. I didn't have that kind of money. But the point was that they didn't sell to people who had the resources to be able to afford them in the kinds of numbers where dealers said, send us more. In fact, they sat on dealer lots. Dealers traded them amongst themselves. And it wasn't until it was announced in 98 that there wouldn't be any more that there was sort of a sales splurge going on with them. So we as enthusiasts, in effect, create a demand that sometimes we don't follow up with, actually finding our hard-earned cash to make it happen.
I think perhaps you touched on something there, is that the people who had the money didn't buy them, but I think maybe that's because they didn't understand them yet.
Did they even market it well?
Yes, they did. The ad campaigns, Laura, were positively brilliant for those years for the Defender.
Okay. I just don't remember them. That's why I'm asking. I never saw any commercials on them.
Right. You saw in print, very little television, much more print. But in the 90s, print was still a viable option and a reasonable one for it.
I do want to read this one quote that she had. It's the end of it, pertained to us about the new Defender and coming up. The question they ask, of course, is it's not far off, and will it resonate with traditionalists? And Kim says, this is going to be a new modern expression, but we haven't left behind what you expect of it in terms of capability. Defender is a model that can stretch by itself from something that's very basic to something that's perhaps a little more luxury focused. You'll probably see a wide range there. It'll be fun. I can't wait. That's a wide-ranging statement, but I think it's, I think everybody can pick something up out of that and hold on to it, that maybe there'll be something they like of the new upcoming Defender. At least that's the positive statement. The positive thought I take out of that statement.
The challenge to me, as a Land Rover enthusiast, assuming that I could afford one, would be that a part of my entertainment, if you will, my emotional satisfaction with my Land Rover, is that I can maintain my Land Rover. And the reality is, new vehicles are very difficult for do-it-yourself mechanics because of the technology built into them and the requirements for electronic diagnoses that you have to have on board now. Vehicles simply have to do so much more to simply be sold anywhere. I have no question about the capability off-road of anything called a Defender. No question about it whatsoever. But a part of the off-road experience is field repairability. Now, new electronically controlled vehicles have less maintenance issues than old ones do. But when something goes wrong, the question will be, will you be able to diagnose and repair it such that when you're overlanding in one, you're not stranded? That's the sort of unanswered point to this. And my sense is it's going to be very hard to accomplish at the beginning But just as diagnostic scanners, handheld scanners, have now come down in price such that the enthusiast can buy one without opening up a shop to support it, I'm quite confident it will happen. And it may be that smartphone apps become our diagnosis tool more than our stethoscope, where we listen to tap it noise or something of that sort.
That's a good point, Jeff. And it kind of, you know, that's a thought that goes through my head quite often, you know, when I get to a point where I need a certain machine to repair a certain vehicle. It's, do I invest in that machine or not? And a lot of times, you know, the decision is, well, I'm just not going to do that sort of repair anymore, because if I'm going to invest $20,000 in a machine, I'm a slave to that machine now. I don't own it. It owns me, because in order to pay for it, I've got to constantly be working that machine and doing jobs that, frankly, aren't the kind of jobs that really I enjoy doing. And I'm doing those just to pay for the machine that allows me to do them.
Right. Well put.
And I know several others in my industry that feel the same way.
Sure. Sure. I know the same. I think what we're going to see, though, as we're starting to see now, is interoperability between a smartphone or tablet applications and the software in vehicles. You already see it happening. And if a vehicle can be controlled from a tablet or a smartphone through an app, then it can also diagnose through both. And that may
right.
be the point that allows us to still have an intimate enjoyment with maintaining our vehicle as much as we have with off-roading it and or driving it about and using it.
I agree. I will tell you, though, just, you know, sort of the short answer on what's it going to be like, I guarantee that you're going to have to carry more than 6 spanners and a hammer.
Harold, I have an 80-pound toolbox in the back of my 2A, and so I take it on everywhere, whether it's a little trip around the island for work or this recent trip I took to New York.
No, I get it. And that's a fairly comprehensive thing that should allow you to handle anything that your truck throws at you. But
right.
On the other hand, an 80-pound toolbox that fits in the back of an 88 is still a very small complement of tools.
Yes, by
so
a shop
what, standard. When I say 6 spanners and a hammer, I'm speaking figuratively, in other words.
Oh, I understand fully. But a fellow like Bruce Fowler, who organizes the Maine Winter Romp, carries a multimeter and about 6 spanners and a hammer.
Yeah.
And he never seems to get stranded like I do.
You know, it's funny you'd say that, because I've had that opinion before. It seems like the more tools I carry, the more likely I am to need them.
And I think our Land Rovers know that. You know that?
So that's the news for December. We will be back after this short break with our year in review of 2016 with our guests, Jeff and Laura. Welcome back to the Center Steer Podcast, show number 45 for December 2016. And now we're going to do something new for the show. We're going to do year in review, I guess, for Land Rover. Well, I guess we're calling it year in review. Insert your own jingle here. We have taken and looked over the stories for the past year, and we decided on there's 4 stories. We'll call it your top 4 stories of things that we think Land Rover were important for Land Rover again for the past year. There you go. We're going to do top 4 stories. So first one up is sales. Land Rover sales have been doing gangbusters for the past year. They are up and continue to sell well, especially here in the United States. And I think this only bodes well for Land Rover. But, of course, there's I think it comes at a cost, at least as I see it, because the changing nature of the vehicles and what they look like, especially, and how they've become more electronic, I suppose, more computerized. So, sales are up, but I think they're pointing to a certain demographic that is changing who's buying the vehicles. And I think those of us who enjoy what we call heritage not so much. It's overall good for the company, but I don't know that it's necessarily good for the those of us who like driving and like the Land Rovers as they were.
The dilemma for Land Rover, particularly for Land Rover enthusiasts, is the same dilemma or a similar dilemma confronted by Porsche enthusiasts. 80% of Porsche's new car sales are it's Pan America, it's Cayenne, it's Macan. So it's the SUVs and four-door sedans. Only 20% or so of the sales are the cars that we initially associate with Porsche, the Boxster, the 911 series, in other words. Porsche could not continue as a relatively independent company, could not produce the engineering required for the sports cars without the profits that accrue from vehicles that, to some, are outside of Porsche's orbit. Maserati came into the U.S. and discovered quickly it needed to produce an SUV in order to have a sales presence in the U.S. market. Alfa Romeo, in reintroducing itself, is coming out with, indeed has announced, an SUV. A small one, but an SUV nonetheless. Jaguar sales were hurt for a number of reasons, but one of them is that Jaguar had no all-wheel drive vehicle, and its dealership network did not have an SUV under the Jaguar name, and thus the F-Pace. It has been a big push for Jaguar. It brings people into dealerships. The challenge for Land Rover remains that it needs to extend the demographic who want to buy a Land Rover. The enthusiast, ourselves, I will say, do not necessarily step forward for the newer Land Rover product, even at the LR4 enthusiast level. Not because we don't love them, but because a part of our love and affection for the Land Rover is your involvement in either its maintenance, its customization, its upgrades, its orienting, its use around different issues. These are harder and harder to make happen in a highly regulated automobile environment. And when we worry, for example, about the look of the Discovery, you simply can't sell an SUV like an LR4 that gets maybe 20, low 20s miles per gallon when your regulatory environment says you need to hit 50 miles a gallon across your fleet line in upcoming years. It's not going to happen with V8 engines in heavy, boxy vehicles. That doesn't mean I don't love that look and I wouldn't prefer that look. I do. But I simply know that you cannot make that happen on the number of vehicles that Land Rover produces worldwide, which is barely 500,000. Mercedes can continue the Geländewagen in the U.S. because it's a peripheral niche vehicle amongst their far greater selling fleet in terms of total numbers. So a few Geländewagens at $100,000 don't really hurt the fuel economy average overall for the larger Mercedes lineup. The Land Rover has a small lineup in the U.S. They're crowing right now because they're going to cross 50,000 vehicles over the course of a year. That just isn't very many when every vehicle has to give you some leg up on the fuel economy standards.
Yeah, because the Land Rover's, share of the market in the U.S. is something like 1%. Is that right?
It is so low. It's below 1%, and it's so low that I screwed it up in my column a couple of issues back and got a letter to the editor correcting my mathematics. It was too difficult for me to deal in a percentage that small. Yeah. It's less than 1%.
Yet sales are continue as well. You make a good point, though. The sales continue, and the name stays out there, and I guess it really does have to do with the fact of fuel economy and. But there's still old vehicles out there, which is – so we can continue. Right. So for those enthusiasts, we can buy the old vehicles.
We'll just buy the 70% that are still on the road.
Yeah.
That's right. And Land Rover knows that we're going to do that. What it can't do anymore is to produce, if you will, a new vehicle and sell it in the U.S., even sell it in Europe, if it is fuel inefficient, overly heavy, and doesn't meet crash standards. As much as I love the body-over-frame manufacturing process for the purpose of being able to work on a vehicle myself, I recognize that it will not meet contemporary crash standards and therefore can't be sold.
So, and it's difficult to produce because it's the time and attention to build the Defender in particular. It took a lot of man hours and it took a lot of time to
With the Defender, but it's not just the body on frame aspect of the Defender that's difficult. It's the way the body is assembled piece by piece by hand on the frame.
Mm-hmm.
But compared with the Discoveries, the D1s, D2s, et cetera, that's a body on frame, but it's more conventional. The shell is assembled and then just dropped on the frame. It's less labor intensive. And I don't think either one of the, I don't think that necessarily body on frame equates to low crash worthiness, because I think the Disco is far more crash worthy than the Defender. But certainly the way the Defender's made, you can't do it that way and be crash worthy.
Right. But to just open up the discussion a little further, the crash standards of the first of the Defender, the Discovery 1 and 2, are not the crash standards that a new vehicle has to meet. They're more extensive now.
You are correct, but I don't think necessarily that being body on frame would put you out of that club. It's difficult, but I think it's still possible.
Well, that may be the case. You may be absolutely right on that. That's where the issue of body on frame and overall weight becomes a problem.
Right. Weight, fuel consumption, that sort of thing. Definitely that's where the body on frame puts themselves out of the market.
And the other dilemma for Land Rover is the ever-growing increase on the number of airbags and the cocoon protection required on the interior of a vehicle. You know,
yeah.
I love the fact that the Discovery 1s and 2s, Range Rover Classics, are relatively narrow, certainly narrow in an American sense. And part of the beauty of that is when you are off-roading in woods or tight trail situations. But you can't actually make airbags that will work in that narrow environment. You need a bigger vehicle.
Right, you need space for them to deploy.
That's exactly it. So, these are, again, these are the issues that the rational side of Land Rover has to confront. Emotionally, again and again, I'm struck by how many Land Rover executives that I meet at various auto shows and the like will have, so let me step back. They are present at an event because they have helped engineer, design, or been in overall charge of the redesign of a Land Rover model. But again and again, we each will pull out a phone, and on their phone will be a much more heritage-oriented Land Rover that they have as their pleasure vehicle, if you will. They recognize the difference. They are truly enthusiasts. Highlight is the extraordinary sales success of the Range Rover Sport.
I was unaware of that one, actually. I didn't pay attention.
Oh, my gosh. John, read through their numbers that they send out. The Sport is really, in many ways, the largest selling model at the moment. It has just struck a chord with buyers who may not be off-road oriented, but should they choose to take a Sport off-road, they'll find it hugely capable. But this is a vehicle that otherwise has the hand on-road handling and accelerative capabilities of any luxury high-performance sedan. It's an amazing product, and it has really sold well in the U.S.
And I think one of the reasons for that is that I think it buyer mentality is that it's more Range Rover than the Evoque, but it's still cheaper than a full proper Range Rover.
It's also smaller, which helps.
Yeah,
it is smaller.
But Laura, weren't there a couple of Range Rover Sports, older ones, at SCAR last year?
Yes, we do. We have a few Range Rover Sports, and I think we even maybe had a full-size Range Rover at our event.
Right. And it is amazing because the Sport is every bit as capable as any other Land Rover model. It's extraordinary to watch it perform that well.
All right, next on our review of the past year for Land Rover is vehicles. So Land Rover came out with the Disco Sport, which in here in the U.S. Replaced the LR2 and the Freelander around in the rest of the world. And, you know, they announced the Disco 5 was announced just in the past couple months. That's coming out as a next year model year. And, of course, they've started to shop and discuss, as we talked about in the news just a few minutes ago, the Range Rover Sport Coupe, or Coupe, is coming. So all these models have come out. They've completely redone, as we've seen for the past couple of years, they've completely redone the whole lineup. And, of course, we know the Defenders coming up as one of the families. And they've moved into this, I guess as a recap, too, they've also moved into this family structure where you have the Range Rover family, you have the Discovery family, and then the Defender family. And they've completed this year the Discovery family rollout. And so the Disco 5 seems to be somewhat controversial, at least for me, but it's good that they're refreshing models and bringing them out and updating them. You know, the 5, to me, it kind of fits that new style that they're having, which to me is less Land Rover-y, if that makes any sense. It's not as boxy as I was hoping it to have, and that, you know, the raised roof in the back is so minuscule you have to use a magnifying glass to see it. You know, and then they've kind of changed some other things, and it's, I don't know, it doesn't feel Land Rover-y to me. But
I think you should have the Range Rovers look like Range Rovers, but the Discovery shouldn't look so much like a Range Rover. You should have a distinct style for each one. That makes it different, because, you know, everybody wants, you're going to have the individuals who wants that higher end vehicle, but you will have that midsize type vehicle. And I mean, all the car makers are starting to do that. Everything's starting to look the same. There's, you know, used to, you could tell when you looked at a Ford, you could tell the different models of the Ford, or if you're looking at a Nissan, but everything's starting to look alike. And I think, you know, I guess it's just the way it is, but I think Land Rover should keep the Discoveries looking like a Discovery, and then go to the Defender and make it look like a Defender, like make it unique.
I mean, yes.
If they're going to say we're their commercials above and beyond, then they need always stay one step ahead from all the other competitors. And why, that's how you keep to the tradition. You may have the looking modern look, but make each one model different.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah, yes, each family, I kind of like your thought there. You know, each family could have its own distinct kind of look or feel to it, and then have, which, instead of, I do agree with you, or, you know, the Rangies look like the Discos, or I guess now Discos look like Rangies, really.
Yeah, that's my only gripe with the D5 is that it does look too much like the Range Rover family.
So I have to throw out a thought from the former general manager at Land Rover Scarborough, which is Maine's only dealership. I believe it is when the LR3 came out that I got on a soapbox, and Laura read my mind, because I said basically the same thing to him. Why did the LR3 have to look so unlike the Discovery 2? Let alone, why did you have to come up with an Alfa Romeo, alphanumeric name plan for it?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, reliability there.
Yeah. Right. So the interesting point that he raised to me, because he is in he came out of the car sales end, if you will, he said, have you sat in one? And of course, from my purist perspective, no, I wouldn't even get in one because it doesn't look right to me. So he made me get in one. And I realized when I sat in it that it looked very different inside and felt very different inside than it did from the outside. One of the interesting features to me when I first got in and drove any time a Discovery Sport was that it actually felt more like the interior of a classic, of a Heritage Land Rover, than I expected it to from the outside, where indeed its lines still to some degree disappoint me. But we don't spend a lot of time outside a car. We spend time inside a car. And that's what the general manager pushed on me, that it's what it feels like when you're in the car that's so critical. So whatever styling cues are missing, and I accept that I too would prefer to see them there, but in their absence, what happens inside the car, and what's your response to it when you're inside? So does it still have the command driving position? Do you look over a hood line where you can see the ends of the and sides of the front hood or bonnet? When you peer in the rear view mirror, or we are now forced to look at screens, do you have a strong sense of where the end of the car is? Can you center yourself on a trail with that vehicle? That's the interior part. And it is interesting to me as to, it would be interesting to me to see what the new Discovery has as a feel for the inside. Land Rover is launching for the press in the U.S. an event at the end of February, early March, and I'll be going to that. And that is that's where they're actually going to give us a chance to drive on-road and off-road over a few days the new Discovery. So far, it has been launched visually at the Los Angeles Auto Show, right, John?
Yeah.
And then there were some journalists, both in the U.S. and all of Europe, were able to go to Scotland and have some off-road and on-road driving time through the Land Rover Experience School in Scotland. But the U.S. one will be at the end of February, and we'll have a chance to see if they're able to give us that feel, whereas the exterior of the car does not give you that feel.
Interesting point.
We were at Harold and I went to the Finnish Grand Prix, plug that, this past year in Pittsburgh, and there was a Disco Sport and sat in it. And I take your point about sight lines and having that command driving position. I think that was there. But the impression I got sitting inside was just like I get from the outside. It's just like every other vehicle that's out there. It had the same kind of feel to the materials, which is good quality, admittedly. But the layout and...
John, as an aside, if I could, you said you went to the Vintage Grand Prix.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm a Triumph Spitfire owner, right?
Yes.
So I just made a 400-mile trip each way, 800-mile round trip, to visit, in my Series 2A, to visit friends in Connecticut prior to Christmas. He is a car buff, and he went and bought himself a brand-new Mazda Miata, of which he's thrilled, the Club Sport version. So he's more thrilled even.
Ooh,
there on the dashboard, he is forced to have a touchscreen that has to stay up on his dashboard. Mm-hmm. Why? Because you're required to have that camera capability.
The rearview mirror. Yeah, the rearview camera. Yeah.
You know, these situations to me are not ones that the manufacturers have necessarily asked for, but the ones they're stuck with. If you have to put a rearview camera on a Miata when all you have to do is turn your head and look behind you, it's not that big a car.
Right.
You know, so the interior designs cannot be as unique as they once could be.
I guess
because you have the standardization of safety in the interior.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the Disco Sport has to have that big touchscreen in the middle, and it has to be visible. It has to connect properly, has to be able to talk to your phones. It now, as of 2020, has to be able to talk to other cars on the road. Mm-hmm. That rule is going to pass.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So these are design cues. I don't want to fault the manufacturer as much as I want to fault the regulatory bodies. And we as consumers who are saying, you're right, I want to be able to have hands-free phone service, and I don't want to look out the rear of the car to see if somebody's behind me.
They had this device for a while that you would replace the touchscreen. It's called a mirror.
Yes, and I still have one. And I question how much longer we'll see rearview mirrors.
Yeah, I agree, because people can't operate them properly.
Well, and there's your
they don't look.
And there's your problem is it's not that they are required to have a backup camera, which is, you know, federal law here in the U.S. that they seems like from 14 on you have to have a backup camera. But it's that people don't use the current or the older technology that was fine. So I guess in many ways, to your bringing this all together, it's we have only have ourselves to blame.
Well, it's because they want to be on their cell phones and text.
Oh, even before that, people didn't look when they backed up, and I guess a little bit of a rant for me is that I question
whether they're going to look at that screen any more than they looked at the mirror.
I agree with you there.
They do.
Look at the screen, Harold, remember the car beeps at you.
Yeah, people do look at the screen. At least when I've been in rental cars, especially as I have in the last couple months, folks, and I'm with some other people, other colleagues, I do notice they look at the screen because kind of a screen society in a way. But
says the guy with a 109 with a backup camera and a screen mounted in the dash.
Because I have no backup mirror.
Right. Well, you have a screen, so you don't need it.
And I'm also no, that's not true. But I'm also on the right-hand side of the vehicle in a left-hand driving world, so that it does in fact enhance and make things better for me. But yeah, I guess again, my point though is that we've kind of done this to ourselves in a way. Oh, that was my rant. I was going to go down to was especially I think in the U.S. they don't want you to know how to drive. And so all these things that have occurred are because they don't want you to know how to drive. Now, I don't know if that's true. That's been my feeling for it. That's why we don't really have good driving capabilities. We don't have good driving schools. You just, you get a license and you go out and test yourself for a little bit. And then you kind of get a license and off you go. And then you learn as you go. Anyways, that's probably a little bit of a rant goes down a rat hole there. But
To comment on that, the show I was talking about yesterday morning, they discussed just exactly what you said. They don't really want us to drive.
Yeah, and haven't learned. You know, whereas in UK, you go through a long process to get yourself a license. And, of course, they have a different society there where you can get by in life without ever learning how to drive. It's more difficult here, but. Well, that was positive conversation, huh?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
So Land Rover's come out with the two new models, the Disco Sport, Disco 5, kind of try to wrap this up a little bit, and then coming as the Range Rover Sport, and that's we saw those as big Land Rover activity, especially in the vehicle side. Any other comments before we move on?
Again, as someone who still keeps his 2A as his sole car for any sort of work or long trip, I still have to tip my cap to Land Rover that Land Rover is so small in terms of auto manufacturing that it can't afford a dud. And the amazing thing is that Land Rover has not had a dud model in the U.S. market. There has been none that has been a dud. The Freelander didn't sell well here, but it sold like hotcakes in Europe and did its purpose.
It wasn't a bad vehicle. It just didn't do well here.
Right. It didn't sell well here at all. And the Land Rover can't afford much advertising, so introducing an entry-level model to people who don't pay attention to Land Rover is a tough thing to do. It was the challenge for the Discovery Sport. But it's selling much better than the LR2s did.
All right. Next in our review of Land Rover big stories for the year is engines. Coming to the U.S. finally is a diesel engine, and also kind of corporate-wide, they debuted and brought out the Ingenium engine. Those are kind of big things. I admit I'm not the biggest on engines, so... would guys give us a sense of what this means to Land Rover? And because if not mistaken, the Ingenium is their first solely designed engine, because all the other engines that they had in the past came from some other manufacturer that they had retooled.
I wouldn't say that because the series, of course, was their engine, and the evolutions thereof up through the 90s were all based on it.
Well, I thought wasn't that a rope, but from the Rover Car Company, or was that did they design their own?
Well, yeah, but Land Rover was a division of Rover, so I mean, yeah, it's not
true. Good point. So, how does the Ingenium engine fit into Land Rover engine world?
Well, if I could to suggest some thoughts here. Land Rover needs to have an economical diesel in order to sell its vehicles in parts of the world where fuel economy is vital because of fuel costs, such as almost every other place except the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela. I mean, the only countries where you can act, you know, where fuel is frankly totally underpriced. So what they've done is to find a way to make the Ingenium engine. It's been around for a while, a little bit, but they found a way to make it meet U.S. diesel emission standards effectively that are different than European diesel standards. Now, my full understanding is that the EU and the United States, probably at the behest somewhat of manufacturers, are looking to find ways that they could actually come up with one world standard. But right now, the United States, because of sort of the history of smog, was far more concerned about different components of emissions than were the Europeans, who accepted particulates and the like much more openly than we did.
Europe is more concerned with greenhouse gases and global warming, and we're more concerned with the smog components.
Right.
So the heavy regulation here is the oxides of nitrogen, which is actually rather difficult to control with a diesel engine just because of the combustion process. But over there, it's the CO2 that they're more concerned with.
That's well put, Harold.
Which takes different systems to control.
Right. And there's one other component. I had the good fortune to interview the head of the diesel program for the U.S. market over in the U.K. His name was Dharam Nair. And the interesting part of that was I had no understanding of how much the additional burden that putting a vehicle as an off-road capable vehicle makes on the placement and design of the diesel emission component system within the vehicles. They not only had 200 plus engineers and technicians working on this for the U.S., but they also had to make sure that whatever they did, that it would work in all conditions, on road and off. And that, so that's vehicle positioning, speed, different transmission selections and the like. I marvel at just how complicated it all is, because I don't think of those things in my Series 2A.
Certainly not.
The diesel engine, when I first met with Simon Turner, who's the head of the Range Rover program here at Land Rover North America, his estimate was that it would be about, they thought maybe 5% of Range Rover sales, because it came out first in the Range Rover, would be diesel. And it turned out to be closer to 15 to 20% this past year. So it's been a real surprise and a great sales success for them. Having the smaller Ingenium engine lets you go to diesels for the Evoque and Disco Sport. Fuel mileage could improve even more, and it would help their overall fleet average.
Is the Disco Sport going to have a diesel here in the U.S.? That's something I've not seen confirmation of.
Yes, it will. Okay. It will be. That's why the Ingenium is so important.
Gotcha.
It's a smaller engine, and it'll certainly be available for the Evoque. And if it's available for the Evoque, it's going to go into the Discovery Sport. In fact, it may fit the sales possibilities for the Discovery Sport better, different marketing.
That would be the only thing I would consider replacing my Jetta TDI with, is a Disco Sport.
Diesel,
yes.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The Disco Sport already is. I think it's 26 miles a gallon overall. Mileage number for overall, and the idea that you could have a 32 to 35 gallon Discovery vehicle, fabulous.
Not only that, but once you've experienced the drivability of a good diesel engine, you don't want to go back to gasoline.
No, man, I love that turbo diesel in the.
No, it's addictive.
It is
very much so. I was
I did get to road test this past year, Range Rover V6 diesel. It was quite something.
I can actually squeal the snow tires in my turbo diesel Jetta, Jeff.
should squeal the ones on my 2A, John, but only if it's stuck in something.
This is coming off the line of, at a traffic light.
I can bark up the snow tires in third gear if I'm really, really working at it.
That's fabulous.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean,
great torque. See, the torque for off-roading can't be beat.
Yeah, and torque is what matters. Horsepower is meaningless.
Right, exactly.
And I take it that manuals are out for the U.S., right? I think that's kind of a foregone conclusion, right? We're all going to be all automatics here.
I'm afraid for mission purposes, it has to be.
Yeah.
If you bring in a standard transmission, you actually have to EPA certify it separately from the automatic drive and transmission. So it's an expensive, exhaustive maneuver. For what percentage? I mean, Jaguar, at least you can get a stick shift on the true sports car.
Right, but you can't sell it. You can't sell enough Land Rovers with manual to justify the cost of certifying it.
That's my feeling.
Yeah, and really the automatics have gotten so good that the fuel mileage is better with the automatics. Unless you're unless you're a trained professional driver and know exactly when to shift and how, you're not going to beat the automatics with the computer doing that for you.
Right, right. And they're 8 and 9 speed now, so they're
right. So you don't even notice the shift, and it's always at the right speed. And yeah,
again, no, it's not my preference. I will keep all three of my vehicles that I currently own have a manual transmission, and I will keep those ancient creaking vehicles going precisely for that reason. But I understand fully the challenge it presents for the U.S. market. For the rest of the world, it's not as big an issue. And there are manuals, obviously, in the U.K. and
The great thing about it as a side effect is that since nobody sells a manual transmission anymore, well, at least practically nobody does, nobody steals them either. The car thieves don't know how to drive stick. And when you have a manual transmission vehicle with 4 sticks coming up out of the floor, it's even more confusing to the thieves. Especially if it's all on the wrong side.
Just leave your transfer case lever in neutral or the overdrive lever in neutral. They'll never figure it out.
That's true.
Oh, no.
It's not going anywhere.
Shall we move on to our final top Land Rover news story theme for the year? And that is So as we've been talking about here, Heritage, the restoration line. So Land Rover officially announced and has put into operation with the kind of the conclusion of the Defender production is the restoration line. They've dedicated time, space, and monies to restoring old vehicles. I think they're starting with the series trucks first, and then they're not only are they going to actually restore the vehicle themselves for you, but they're also producing a line of parts that, if I'm not mistaken, some that have not been previously available. So I think that's a big story. That's as much as we have complained, as we even do on this show, about their focus on selling new and modern vehicles, this is a nice hand, I suppose, to supporting the heritage vehicles and those of us who like the legacy and are the enthusiasts.
It was a fascinating presentation to attend when it was first announced at least publicly for the New York Auto Show, was to realize that they were actually going to seek out Series 1s and for rebuilding with an eye towards making it possible for an enthusiast to have a Series 1 built to factory standards with parts that are actually meeting the expectations of that era. So these are not together things that could be that could fit in a Series 1. It's not that complicated a vehicle. But where parts are not available, Tim Hannig, we actually want to get those parts remanufactured, made again, so that the right part is available. To care about the Series 1 at a time of, again, relatively limited resources is a big step to do it. We were lucky that in effect, Jaguar had that XKSS series to continue, and because it really was the one that allowed both arms of this combined company to have a quality heritage program of that nature. I would love to see one. I have not seen one in person that has been rebuilt. I've only seen photos of them. And just to know how many of the people who worked on the last of the Defenders asked to have jobs working on rebuilding, remanufacturing these Series 1s, you have an awful lot of knowledge that was captured and kept within the company because of that. That's a great program.
I think what's really cool about it is that, I mean, you know, one of the things that I really like about Land Rover, and I think it's true for a lot of us, is that Land Rover is relatively well focused on their heritage and arguably better than most companies, because you can still get parts for most of the old stuff. And, you know, maybe it's not all genuine, but some of it's aftermarket. But, I mean, there's a fair amount of genuine parts still available for the old ones. However, the Series 1, I mean, there's a big difference between a Series 1 and the Series 2s, 2As, 3s, et cetera. And the coverage of parts for the Series 1 is far less than the other series. So it's really nice to see them put that focus into the Series 1 to get that rolling. Because it's nice.
Yes, that was well put, Harold. Yeah.
I mean, as a Series 1 owner, I it's a project at this point, but I'm accumulating parts, and the parts are a little difficult to get. So it's nice to know that, you know, with this program, there's going to be more parts availability for the Series 1s.
Is any of that unobtainium? Are there going to be parts that were never available? Do we know that?
Yes, for example, I'll give an example because I mentioned it when interviewed Tim Hannick, who runs the program. I was describing my concerns about the fact that I didn't have a spare light ignition key unit for my 2A. It's essentially similar to the one in the Series 1. You can get the ignition tumbler, but you can't get the rest of the unit. Nobody makes them anymore. I know that there's a few new and old stocks around. There was a little bit of remanufacturing done, but can stock them per se. And Tim said that's exactly the kind of thing we don't want, to have one that might fail on some. So that's the kind of part that we need to look at getting remanufactured such that you have a new part fits and works just like the old one did, but being new, you can expect it to last. Harold, why do you love your Series 1?
Well, I don't know that I would say I love it any more than the others, but I mean, the thing I like about it is that it is different. I like things that are different. I mean, that's kind of part of why I'm into this stuff, is because I'm the guy in town with all those crazy, weird Land Rovers. You know, I drive an ex-military ambulance as my shop truck. So the opportunity to have a Series 1, oh, yeah, definitely. I'm all over that.
Is yours an 80 or an 86-inch?
Mine is final year. It's an 88.
88. So it's the last one as well. I love the flat ab side of those. On the early ones, I love that little curved bucket seat that you've got.
Yeah, yeah. Everything's just a little different. And once you become complacent with the series truck, this is a chance to be different yet again.
Right. And that 1.6 motor. I mean,
I'm not doing. Actually, mine is mechanically Series 3, and the engine is a Benz diesel. So, no, it's not a true Series 1. It just looks like it.
Got it. Okay. All right.
I like the original door. I just think that door handles.
I like the original, too. And if you ever find a 107, Harold, that needs a home, you'll let me know.
Okay. You'll be second on the list.
Good. That's good for our podcast listeners. Anybody got a 107 sitting out there? I think you might have found a buyer or two.
You have. You would love one. Both of us.
And there's one more story that I can't believe we all missed, and we hinted at it, that is probably for us especially is the biggest news for Land Rover in the past year, is the end of the production of the Defender.
It was an amazing event, and the fact that Land Rover actually put the time, energy, and money into celebrating the vehicle while they were ending production of it is extraordinary.
Nobody does that.
We had some photos in Rover's magazine, but when I interviewed Roger Craythorne and heard just how many company employees were there, what it meant to them. Land Rover treated this very soft, appropriately. And it was very impressive to see that they treated it as a celebration.
I don't think anybody else has ever thrown a party because they're stopping production of something.
That's just what I was trying to think of, Harold, as I was speaking. I can't think of a company that just didn't quietly get rid of a model. They celebrate the reemergence of something, but never the ending of it.
Oh, yeah. Everybody celebrates when the first one, but nobody ever celebrates the last one.
Right.
Certainly not in the style that that Land Rover did. And it's good to bring up that Land Rover did, in fact, celebrate and made a big production of the fact that it was the end of the Defender line and in the way it was. So certainly, or at least the end of the way those were currently built. And as we all know, they know that line goes all the way back to the very foundation and the very beginning of Land Rover. And there's that connection, even if it is only, what, three parts? I don't even know if that's true, but let's pretend that it is. There are three parts that have continued from the beginning yes. until the end. You know, that's very cool.
it was an amazing experience, as well as a sad experience to recognize that it had happened.
Yes, and I guess it's also important to point out, and I suspect that this will be one of our predictions coming up, is that this really isn't the end of the Defender. It's just more the end of the way it was built, and there it will come back. And, of course, then there will be the big debate as to whether it really is a Land Rover or is it really a Defender. But that we can leave that for later. I guess it's truly not the end of the Defender. It's just the end of how it was built, but that line still continues. So that is kind of the Land Rover year in review as we see it. If you have, dear listener, an idea, feel free to post on Facebook or tweet at us or send me an email, and maybe we'll bring it up in a future episode. Kind of interested to hear what others think. So that concludes our year in review for Land Rover 2016. Coming up very soon, right after the Heritage segment, we are going to talk about predictions for 2017 and beyond. Stay tuned. It's time for Morgan, all the way from the Green Mountain State in Vermont, to talk about Range Rover Classic gearboxes and transfer cases for our Heritage segment this month. Take it away, Morgan.
Thank you very much. This month, we continue the technical deep dive into what we now refer to as the Range Rover Classic. It all started when the original Range Rover debuted in 1970 as the Range Rover Company's entry into the SUV market after more than 20 years of the simple utilitarian Land Rover series vehicles. We've already covered how the chassis, suspension, wheels, brakes, and axles set this vehicle apart in terms of comfort, as well as on and off-road capability from those Land Rover series vehicles and where they remained similar. Today, we'll continue up the drivetrain and cover the gearbox and transfer case in the Range Rover Classics and the developments and improvements over the years. Unlike the Land Rover series vehicles before it, the Range Rover took four-wheel drive to another level right off the line by using a permanent four-wheel drive transmission. No longer was the driver deciding whether to be in rear-wheel drive or four-wheel drive and needing to consider in advance the different handling and capabilities that the two modes would provide. This made for safer driving, as well as gave four-wheel drive functionality as soon as it was needed. It still offered the driver a choice between high range for normal driving conditions and low range for when the going got tougher. Like the series Land Rover, the Range Rover had a hydraulic-operated clutch release. However, instead of using a separate gearbox and transfer case, they designed a new four-speed manual unit with an integrated transfer case. This was the LT95, and as mentioned, featured full-time four-wheel drive, high and low range, and a vacuum servo engaged center locking differential. From June through December of 1970, roughly 300 Range Rovers were produced with LT95 transmissions featuring a Salisbury power lock limited slip locking center diff. But afterwards, all the units used the manual selected locker. The LT95 received some upgrades throughout the years, mostly in the form of high-range transfer case gearing increases in 1976 and 1979. In 1977, a Ferry Overdrive became available for the LT95 as well. As briefly mentioned in a previous segment, in 1980, Schuler Presses, who later became Overfinch, released their Land Rover-approved Super Ranger, which featured an upgraded gearbox and transfer case, as well as ABS brakes. For the gearbox, Schuler used a three-speed Chrysler A727 Torque Fleet automatic gearbox, which, in addition to providing the convenience, also halved gearbox noise and maintained the same fuel economy of the LT95 transmission. They mated this gearbox to a custom Schuler Voith chain-driven transfer case, which featured Ferguson Formula full-time four-wheel drive. I've seen some conflicting information, but I believe the Ferguson Formula viscous control unit distributed one-third of the power to the front and two-thirds to the rear. Land Rover went as far as commissioning 25 of the Schuler upgraded Range Rovers, which they sold through dealers to gauge interest in Range Rovers with automatic transmissions. In fact, in 1981, the first ever Paris-Dakar rally was won by Land Rover France, driving a Range Rover fitted with the Schuler FF transmission, as the Schuler with Ferguson Formula four-wheel drive came to be known. This helped prove the off-road prowess of the Range Rover and coincided with the first year of Land Rover vehicles being used for the venerable Camel Trophy events. The Range Rover was the vehicle of choice for the 1981, 1982, and 1987 Camel Trophies, though I believe those used the stock transmissions. Of course, we can't forget the achievement of the earlier 1972 crossing of the Darien Gap in a Range Rover either. Regarding the stock transmission, 1981 also saw minor upgrades to the LT95 to reduce whine and supposedly increase fuel efficiency by 25%. In 1982, the special edition Range Rover En Vogue was released with the same three-speed Chrysler Torque Fleet automatic gearbox that Schuler had introduced 2 years prior, though mated to Land Rover's own LT230 transfer case instead. This configuration became a factory option on other Range Rover models as well. The following year, in 1983, the four-speed integrated LT95 transmission was replaced with a five-speed LT77 gearbox mated to the LT230R transfer case. This LT77 gearbox was later referred to as the long stick LT77 due to the length of the gear selector. Unlike the LT95's integrated transfer case, which used a vacuum engaged center locking diff, the LT230R's center diff was manually engaged. Sometime between 1984 and 1986, the LT230R was replaced with the LT230T, which featured stronger taper bearings instead of roller bearings. 1985 saw the five-speed manual LT77 gearbox replaced with the LT77-53A, also known as the short stick. In the automatic option, the three-speed Chrysler Torque Fleet was replaced with a four-speed ZF4HP22 gearbox, and both configurations retained the LT230 transfer case. In 1988, the automatic gearbox became standard equipment on the Range Rover Vogue SE. The LT230 was also replaced with a BorgWarner chain-driven transfer case featuring a limited-slip viscous coupling. Chain-driven transfer cases are generally lighter and quieter, though not quite as strong as gear-driven transfer cases. The five-speed LT77 manual gearbox saw several improvements around 1988 and 1989, including four bearings for the lay shaft, new ratios, and an oil pump and cooler. In 1991, it was replaced with the LT77S, which had double synchros for first and second gears, plus a redesigned synchro hub for third and fourth. These remain mated to the BorgWarner chain-driven transfer case. The LT77S was ultimately replaced with the new five-speed manual R380 in 1994 for the last couple years of the Range Rover Classics production. While this brings us to the end of Range Rover Classics gearbox and transfer case history, there are some upgrade and modification options to take into consideration. For those models fitted with the LT230 transfer case, roughly 1983 to 1989, there are some gear ratio change kits available. Ashcroft Transmissions in the UK provides four different high-range gear kits, which can provide better highway driving speeds depending on tire size and engine type. These only change the high ratios and cost between £225 and £240 at this time. I believe you also need a separate 95-pound rebuild kit to get all the necessary bearings and seals. GBR Utah, formerly Great Basin Rovers, offers two low-range gear reduction options. They're based out of the U.S. Their options are 30% reduction and 50% reduction. These kits feature straight-cut spur gears, which should be more durable than the stock helical-cut gears, but tend to be louder. Since these are only for low range, you won't hear them during normal driving conditions, unless you are fortunate enough to live where you're doing all your driving in adverse off-road condition. These kits cost about $1,900 US at this time, but they include new bearings, low gear wheel, intermediate seal, output seals, and a drain plug. Naturally, both the Ashcroft and GBR gear change kits require removal and disassembly of the LT230 for installation, and they actually can be combined with each other if you so please. For the earlier LT230R transfer case, the LT230T is a bolt-on replacement, so it's an easy swap if you're having trouble finding parts to rebuild the earlier model. While we're on the LT230, the BorgWarner chain-driven transfer case can actually be replaced with the LT230 if you need a stronger gearbox and want to change the gearing. Naturally, some people swap out automatic gearboxes for manuals, replace earlier integrated LT95 transmissions with newer separate gearboxes and transfer cases, or sometimes put the 5-speed manual R380 in earlier models. All of these require small to extreme amounts of engineering to make fit. For example, fitting the R380 into a late 70s model Range Rover Classic requires significant modifications to the footwells, pedal assemblies, etc. So, as usual, these sorts of upgrades require a lot more research, planning, time, and money, but there are obviously still some benefits to those if you choose to do them. I think that's it for this month's coverage of the Range Rover Classic. Next time, we'll continue up the drivetrain and cover engines. That said, if Harold has any other modifications that he has frequently heard of, love to hear of those as well.
There's always things you can do, but I think you gave a good overview.
Excellent. Yeah, I've seen all sorts of crazy hacks, and as our one listener who donated requested, we'll have to get into some more of those. I think he was more looking for Disco One upgrades, but we'll get into hackier stuff.
I like the notion of the Torque Flight installation. I've always wanted to get my hands on one of those because I think it'd be kind of cool. Because once you get into a Torque Flight case, you have a lot of options because you can take the back half of one Torque Flight that's mated to the LT230 and the front half of another Torque Flight, which happens to be mated to something else significantly more powerful, and you sort of got a built-in adapter, if you will. You can actually engineer within the transmission a really cool engine combination without having to go to a stack of advanced adapters.
That's very true. It has a lot of possibilities.
Been wanting to try that with a Cummins.
Ooh.
For instance.
Yeah. Were you thinking like 4BT or?
Oh, hell no.
No, up to the 6.
If you're doing it, go big or go home, dude.
Exactly. Very nice.
So this extreme off-road situation that you say people live in, that sounds like Vermont to me.
No, even in Vermont, we don't get to drive in low range all the time.
Well, you could if you wanted to. It's not like, it's going to, significantly add to the distance across your state.
No, it doesn't change the distance at all.
Nobody drives over 40 miles an hour anyway in Vermont, right?
The Canadians do.
Well, because yeah. they're having trouble converting from kilometers.
Yeah. Interestingly, driving across the state is fairly difficult. There's only a couple of routes to actually do that. North and south is very easy. Well, it's almost as much time to drive east to west in some parts as it is to drive the entire north-south distance.
Isn't there a mountain range down the spine of the state? Is that right?
There's a couple. Yeah, yeah, the Adirondacks actually run most of the way up the state.
So your next vehicle is going to be a Range Rover. Is that what you're saying? Range Rover Classic?
I actually had hoped to pick up a Range Rover Classic before I picked up my Disco. But yeah, I would love to do that.
Well, thanks very much, Morgan, for giving us the next installment of our Heritage segment, talking about the Range Rover Classic.
Thanks for having me.
And I encourage everyone to visit seriesparts.com. That is Morgan's website that he manages for all of your series parts needs. Finding them, tracking them down. You don't actually sell the parts, of course. You're just giving people the information so they can go find parts, find a mechanic to help them out. Something else. I'm forgetting what's the other thing that you help out with.
Basically, parts suppliers and garages and restoration shops.
So visit seriesparts.com. Welcome back once again to the Center Steer Podcast. This is show number 45 for December 2017. I keep saying that because, I don't know, I just want to make sure I know what month we're in. And coming back to the show, we want to talk about predictions or ideas, thoughts for the upcoming year, and just kind of generally throw it all in as predictions and maybe even some New Year's resolutions, I guess, thrown in there. And we have three big broad swaths that we'd like to talk about. And the first one we're going to take is Land Rover is moving, as you've heard, and we talked in the news, an earlier story, you know, they talk about moving more, I guess, upscale luxury and using increasingly more technology into the brand and using more premium tools and more premium quality products. And then there's even discussion as to whether they need to compete with Bentley with their coming out with their new SUV. So Land Rover seems to be, especially certainly here in the U.S., has always been considered, I think, a luxury brand. It's continuing with that. And, you know, they have the Range Rover. What they just this past year came out with the Autobiography Edition here in the U.S. I don't think it had been in the U.S. before. Am I right or wrong on that one? And so, you know, you can spend as much money as you want on a Land Rover, and they'll happily take your money. You know, so it certainly seems that they are in this luxury band and seem to continue to push that and move up. And even I think you see that with all introduction of the new family models that have come into play. So I guess that's the prediction, is there, I think you're going to continue to see, and maybe with a new Defender coming in, it's going to be a little more luxury than it certainly had been in the past.
Well, John, I'd like to introduce the thought, because I think it's consistent with what Land Rover has articulated, and that's that it is less an issue of how much luxury, but it's really an issue of retaining Land Rovers as premium product. Harold, you go back to your days of your 107s or the first Series 2s, 109s. The price tag on those compared to, say, a Jeep of that same time period was almost a $2,000 differential, which in the 1950s and early 1960s was a staggering climb.
Oh, yeah. That's a lot of money back then.
It was a lot of money back then, and it certainly hurt sales in terms of the idea that I want a utility vehicle, but it also signaled where Land Rover intended itself to remain. It did not discount the vehicle in the U.S. Land Rover didn't really alter and sort of make a U.S. version to a cheaper premium standard. Only 50,000 vehicles sold in a year. You have to articulate a niche that you fill. And the niche that Land Rover has filled so well is that of a premium SUV, one that will do a great deal more than just transport you off-road or hold a lot of gear. It is a vehicle that has so many multiple capabilities, all of them, frankly, at a premium level. We consider to be premium as a group of automotive consumers elevates itself every year. John, you were just saying earlier in a conversation, been on the road a great deal for work, and that you've rented automobiles. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
Yes. So when I the same for other job assignments, I know that when I go into a national rental car chain and I have already reserved the cheapest possible base model, that what is a base model today is nowhere near as base was even 10 or 15 years ago. And that the expectation that we have now of stepping into a vehicle and what it will offer for comfort, convenience, economy, reliability, et cetera, is way greater than what it once was. So the bottom end of the car market keeps pushing Land Rover to look for other ways to signal its premium, and then, of course, to justify its, frankly, premium pricing. But it's the bottom that's pushing up every bit as much as the top, pushing, if you will, with competitive vehicles.
Do you think the average American motorist purchaser thinks of Land Rover as a premium brand? Does that?
Yes, without question.
Do you think it's always been that way? I think it is. Bringing up a discussion point.
No, it has. One of the one books that I came across and picked up was a series of road tests of Land Rovers from the 1960s, 70s, and the pricing to Americans just made no sense. Why is a vehicle with hammers on the outside panels costing, frankly, two and a half times as much as a competitive Jeep or Scout? How do you justify this with a vehicle where the seats are not adjustable, or the or there's one interior and then five colors? That's all. Land Rover created that premium very early in its production, and for the U.S. market, I think understood that it would have to accept that that would be a role it would have, partially because of the British pound and the structure of the pound sterling, and partially because I think it had no choice but to, for the way that it was manufactured and engineered.
Don't you think it also has hurt them, though, here in the U.S.? Because that is, by placing themselves as a premium or luxury brand and higher up on the scale, I think there's an expectation of having better reliability, and that's always been one of their Achilles heels, is the reliability. Hence the reason for the renaming of the Disco and the Freelander, to try to get away from those names here in the U.S., and they only changed the names here in the U.S. to get away from that reliability. I think they have probably a misstep, maybe, is trying to have that greater reliability along with that greater sense of quality that they're trying to push in their marketing and in the, just in the general selling of the vehicles. And I think it's been a challenge for them, I think, in that aspect. Is the reliability, I think, has been a problem here.
I was just going to say, I think there's some confusion amongst the general public in terms of the difference between, number one, luxury and premium. Because they don't necessarily mean the same thing. Something is luxury because it has lots of creature comforts and fancy features, but premium just means it's built to a higher standard. And the other thing is that, and John sort of went there with this, and it's got me thinking, the difference between reliability and durability. And again, if you're built to a higher standard, things are designed to be more durable. That doesn't mean things don't fail, and that hints on the reliability. And where Land Rover has had some reliability problems, durability of the individual parts has been their strong point.
And I would like to suggest John, this is really where your observations are so spot on. It's the American market that has caused so much trouble for Land Rover. Remember, the original 3.5 V8 had problems at a couple hundred thousand miles if you didn't do oil changes, because the camshafts would wear. Otherwise, it was just an underpowered engine for the U.S. expectation at that premium price level, which is Harold's point. It's when they had to bore that engine out that the manufacturing processes made it difficult to have a bored-out linered engine with the durability that Americans expect with low maintenance schedules. Harold, you're in this end of the business more than I, but the Land Rover service techs at the main dealership complained about Land Rover having to change the service requirements to meet the sales expectations of people.
I've heard that before.
Technicians did not want to see 15,000-mile oil changes.
Yeah, I don't like it.
No.
But you're competing against other companies who specify that long of an interval from a sales standpoint. You have to.
That's right. And that's just where the market pushed Land Rover in directions that, in a way, it didn't want to go, because it doesn't have these issues with its preponderance of diesel engines in the same time period in the other markets. So giant Saint Bernard that wants to sit on your lap. You love the dog to death, but it really doesn't it causes its own problems because of the requirements of our marketplace. Now, Land Rover, admittedly, has chosen to play in that marketplace. I mean, they're the ones who have to tackle this.
And they've gotten much better over the last, say, certainly 5 years, maybe 10. They've definitely gotten better.
Oh, you don't hear of people having issues with the LR3s and LR4s at the engine and drivetrain side, right, that we used to hear about with the last Discovery 2s.
And this is also when I get to tell my other fun story that I hear all the time. My friends still always say, hey, how's your Range Rover doing? I'm like, it's not, I don't own a Range Rover. I own, it's like, But that goes to Land Rover when they split that off in North America here, and they had, you know, they got rid of the Land Rover part and they just sold Range Rovers.
And the amusing thing is that when they say, how's your Range Rover, they're actually referring to your ex-military 109.
Right, because they don't, but they don't know any better, and I understand that, and I use an opportunity to educate them if I can. Yeah, it goes to this whole point of this, you know, Land Rover's positioned himself in certain way, in a way here in the U.S. in a certain way, and that has, and then has the way they've done it over the years, and kind of goes all the way back to when they exited the market for the Land Rover, and they just left the Range Rover in, and then it was always the, it was a Range Rover dealership. You didn't go to the Land Rover dealer and then buy the model Range Rover. You went to the Range Rover dealership, and that's. For some reason, it's been, what, 40 years, 30 years, you know, people here still think of that.
Yeah. And I think also for people who really just don't pay attention to cars and aren't car people, I think the Range Rover brand is just more visible to them than the Land Rover brand. It's much more premium and more noticeable, more of a status symbol. So I think that sort of sticks in their mind.
So I guess the takeaway from all this is we now need to say the word premium and not luxury.
Okay, to sum it up, sure.
Sure, it sounds as good as any, right? So why don't we move on in our cavalcade of predictions and ideas and discussions. I did enjoy that discussion, by the way.
Yes, the big prediction is the year. The word of the year is going to be premium.
So moving to the other side of the premium scale for Land Rover, I don't know. Is that a good segue? Probably not. So the new Defender's coming, maybe next year. At least it's what's going to be a 2019 model now. But you know, the thought is it might be finally revealed to us next year. We've talked a lot about that on the show. You know, we will continue to talk a lot about it on the show. It's near and dear to our hearts here on the show. But this the specific thing that had not been discussed, and maybe that we would like to spend a little time here in prediction world, is what's the family going to look like? So, and maybe Defender already is a family. In the past models, because you had the 110, you had the 90, you had the pickups, you had the the truck cab, and then you could do anything you want in the back, even the 130s. So, what do you guys think the what's the family going to look like? Is it going to be? Is there going to be one wheelbase? Is there going to be?
I'm just hoping there is a family, and like you say, multiple wheelbases and body options.
Will there be a Defender Sport?
That could be the 90.
I think the dilemma, John, is the methodology of construction in order to meet crash and, frankly, durability standards now will mean that it will be introduced as a single model to start and that the product line will grow over time. But I doubt it will come out as a full-fledged multiplicity of optional appearances or capabilities right from the get-go.
I think you're probably right.
The family will start with one model.
And just from a development cost standpoint, I think they have to start with one, get that tuned, and then they can respond to the market from there with other offerings.
But by doing that, aren't they going to get away from having the commercial vehicle market that they have done pretty well with, especially in Europe? Are they seeding that or by doing it in that way? Isn't it? Don't you think maybe they need to come out with that commercial version of Defender? Assuming they want to do that in the long run, maybe they're dropping it completely because they want to be premium.
I'm not certain that the marketplace demands it have a truck, pickup truck or lorry capability within it. You know, the pickup was never and still isn't a particularly sizable pickup. You know, there's a cuteness to an 88 pickup that is undeniable. But as an 88 owner who takes the top off his his Land Rover to use it as a pickup, I have to say that it doesn't carry a whole lot. It tows brilliantly, but I need a trailer behind me all the time for work because I can't carry enough in it.
Yeah, as a pickup truck, an 88 is kind of useless if you
ask me. And a 109 is still a short pickup.
But it's not that much different from the compact trucks that have been popular here for decades.
Right, but compact trucks truly purchased for work. I don't see a lot of. I'll tell you this: there aren't a lot of commercial fishermen purchasing those midsize or small pickups.
I know a lot of guys who are techies and wrench junkies and like me that carry their toolbox in the back of a short truck and they'll haul engines and parts and stuff in it because they're inexpensive and they're great for running around town. Yeah, I mean less than it used to be, but I know back 80s and 90s they were quite popular for people who worked with tools and car parts. Not so much in the carpentry side of things because you want to haul lumber and plywood, which is big.
Right, but I guess I think you just hit the point. In the 80s and 90s, because pickups were rarer back then, but today's marketplace, it's very tough to sell a small pickup.
Right. The small trucks aren't what they used to be, but I think they were popular for a long time. I think that they could be popular again, especially if you're talking fuel economies.
I think I agree with you there, Harold. If you could make it work, you could get a lot of gas mileage. A lot of people would like that simple little pickup truck just to haul, like you said, the toolbox, or even like a young kid with a long crew or something like that.
Right.
But I'd put to you guys that I think Ford in particular, with the F-150 being the best-selling vehicle in America and their best-selling vehicle, I think they've purposely engineered their market that way to keep those smaller trucks out by having a vast range of F-150s and even a premium, I'll use that word, F-150 and luxury F-150s too. I think they've... I don't think you're going to see that small SUV coming into the U.S., I guess is my point. I think the F-150 is supposed to be all things to all the people they need.
Well, the thing about there is that they offer an F-150 with a bed smaller than you can get in a compact pickup truck.
Right.
I know because I was just tape measuring one last week.
Sure. Right.
And then Ford did, you have a point there because Ford basically made their little, the Ford Ranger that they slowly... took out like 4 years ago, I think, or 5 years ago.
Yeah, the Ford Ranger has a bigger available pickup bed than the F-150 crew cab.
Anyway, that little off topic for the Defender and the Defender family, but I think it's interesting.
Sorry. Opportunity for me to rant about Ford, but that's okay.
Yeah, no.
It's okay.
Well, John, I want to put an upbeat message in all this. The American manufacturers have demonstrated that people will buy pickup trucks for a variety of uses, family and otherwise.
Oh, yeah.
And the amazing thing is that you can create through the quad cab essentially a sedan-like vehicle that happens to have a large pickup bed in the back.
Or a minivan. Or
It's a big sedan with an open trunk is all it is, really.
Right. So, so there's every possibility that Land Rover could do that, provided it knows that it has a market more than just the U.S. The small pickups, VW, Mazda, Nissan, are all very popular in Europe for specific work purposes or lifestyle purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't sell well here. So the question will be if this is indeed, I think this is the second largest market for Land Rover in the world, is it worth looking at one here, and does your dealer network actually want to have one? Remember that Lincoln and Cadillac both had pickups? Lincoln had pickups for a while?
Correct.
The Blackwood.
Right. Didn't sell worth a damn.
Mm-hmm. Right. Didn't fit in with the brand. Right.
Didn't fit in with the brand. And so that's the dilemma for Land Rover in the long run. Will it fit with the brand such that you can actually marketed effectively here?
But as we were talking before the show, the pickup is a big thing in America. It's not somewhere else. I would throw out that Land Rover has an opportunity to have a market that own a market in the rest of the world that it would have difficulty owning here, which is that pickup. Maybe it might be medium to small size, admittedly, But I think they have that might potentially have an opportunity there to corner that market.
Well, they would, and one of the problems for them is it actually has to be a different platform. That's the challenge. Remember, the 88 and 109 frame could accept anything attached to that frame. So it was relatively easy to construct a pickup, to make a pickup cap and a pickup tub, because the pickup tub was really just part and parcel of the same tub that was the station wagon tub.
But a station wagon platform can be readily modified to a pickup. I mean, look at the El Camino and the Ranchero.
Oh, yeah.
Neither of which is available anymore.
I understand that, but at the time, it was a pickup built on a station wagon platform for a relatively low development cost.
True, but it didn't sell. I mean, I have a fondness for them because they were so interesting to look at, but it didn't sell very well.
Not in this country, no, definitely.
No.
My dad had no
Camino. Only Australia has that really sold, the so-called.
Oh, yeah. They love the Utes over
there. They love them down there, but that's the only marketplace I can think of where that's been successful.
Of course, I think Australia gets all the really cool stuff. That's
Freeland. Just,
I guess maybe my tastes are more in line with the Australian car buyer.
Does that mean that you would own a Freelander TD5, TD4?
You know, if I had to own a Freelander, that would be the excuse to have one, is that TD4.
Oren, you heard it, Oren. Oren's a listener in New South Wales. He has himself a Freelander TD4. Good man. Ooh. So our prediction then, taking all this from what I've heard, is there will be a Defender family, but it probably won't have a pickup.
That would be mine. I just don't see, at least in the U.S. market. Again, it may be a special vehicle thing that they can create, but I don't see that the U.S. market demands one, and I'm not certain that Land Rover needs to play in that relatively expensive field of premium or luxury pickups.
Maybe they allow the aftermarket upfitters to make that segment of the market happen.
Good. That's how convertibles came back into the U.S.
Convertibles, ambulance bodies, Cadillac pickups for the flowers for the funeral. Yeah, all that stuff is all done in the aftermarket.
Right.
So you know what? If when the new Defender comes and you know you buy one and you decide you want to pick up, call me. I'll make it happen.
You'll make it happen, okay, Harold?
Fire up the saw. Exactly.
Hey, I got a sawzall. I got a hammer. I can make that happen.
What I want to know is, Harold, is if they were to have an ambulance body on the new Defender, would you buy that brand new Defender ambulance body?
I got a perfectly good ambulance already. What do I need another one for?
All right, let's move on to our final prediction area, topic of discussion for 2017 and beyond. Overlanding and camping. When I went to the Overland Expo this year, Overland Expo East, admittedly, I was struck, and I've said this before, but I was struck by the number of rooftop tents that are available, and they just seemed like everybody had one. They were everywhere. And, of course, we've talked a lot on this show to people who have overlanded and the Bells and the badass couple, Harold. Well, I forgot their name.
Mr.
already.
And Mrs. Badass. Strangers Like Angels.
Strangers Like Angels. I already forgot their name.
Oh, the Foremans.
The Foremans.
Alec and Jan Foreman.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I'm struck by all that, and there seems to be, especially in the U.S., there seems to be a resurgence of camping and this new notion of overlanding, whatever it means to you, because it means different things to different people. But we'll just call it overlanding. But seems to be a resurgence of that, and it seems to be an increasing interest in it because there's new, I guess, technology around it. You know, you've always had tents, certainly, but now you have a tent that you can put on your roof, and it deploys, and you can have an awning, and it deploys, and you have LED lighting. So I guess a prediction I would see is a greater increase in Americans in particular, camping, overlanding, getting out and about.
I would agree with you there, John. I'd seen an article posted that more people are camping during the holidays. Instead of staying home with the family or going to a resort, they're actually going to a campsite, a state park, and, you know, that's where they're spending Thanksgiving.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that one.
It's one way to get away from the family.
That's right. Well, I mean, and even in the club, we do an annual day after Thanksgiving run to Barnwell Mountain, and we do a chili cook-off and we camp, you know, and it's just kind of like you said, it's nice to get away and you're not doing Black Friday shopping.
Oh, yeah.
But I have noticed that, and even on Facebook, there's a lot more overland groups and a lot more people wanting to go, like, camp to Big Ben, as you were saying. And, mm-hmm. you know, people are asking, I want a rooftop tent. Which one do you recommend? And
certainly a lot more awareness of all that.
Right. And I think you're right, too, John, with the technology that's improved. I mean, you can have a fridge now that you can plug into, you know, to your truck. That, you know, they're coming a little bit more affordable, certain brands for people where they can purchase right. those, or even the solar panels.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, solar technology, I think, has been a great improvement too, because you can take electricity with you, and you're going to have your technology with you, your laptops and your cell phones and things. So that's
actually the beauty of the solar is you don't have to take the electricity with you; you can make it once you get there.
Fair enough. You still need to store it somewhere for evening use.
Right, but you have to pack batteries after batteries after batteries because you can make the power there.
Right.
Yeah, because I think one of our members actually has it where he has he's got the fridge in the back of the truck. He keeps it there every day, and he's got solar panels on his roof rack. And that's how he helps to run and keep the battery charged and the fridge going.
That's far more civilized than that generator humming away all the time.
Yeah, annoying you.
Oh, those. Yeah, there was a Mar one year, and we were camping, and there was a guy pulled up in a motorhome, and he had his generator running, and he took it outside the motorhome and its a little enclosure and put it out. And we're like, God, it was.
Yeah, it's annoying. Yeah.
No, I got you beat. It's those people who think when they're camping, they should still have the radio on blaring at 3 o'clock in the morning, listening to music and talking very loudly.
Or take a TV and then they have their satellite dish with them so that they can watch their camping, quote unquote, and they're watching television inside. I'm like, so why did you do this?
Yeah, clamping.
Yeah.
yes. You've
described the infield at any NASCAR event.
Well, I guess along with the same prediction, you know, I'm going to be doing it myself. I'm going to, you know, I want to take an overland journey this year. I want to take the podcast and try to do a little more field reporting, I suppose, and get out and about. I will ardently try to get to SCAR this year. So that's a little bit of my predictions. Anybody else in the camping area or overlanding, anybody else want to have anything they want to do?
I'm going to be attending the 30-year Land Rover Switzerland Jubilee in July.
What?
July 14th through the 16th. But I'll be arriving early so I can do other sightseeing.
So tell us more. What is the 30th Jubilee? What is it, the 30th Jubilee?
Yes. I'm friends with Mark Blazer. He owns an independent Land Rover shop in Switzerland called City Garage. And I'm real good friends with him and his wife. And we just send care packages back and forth, and he's been wanting me to come. So I'm actually going to take my niece for her high school graduation and to expose her to something, you know, to worldly travel. And we're going to be going to visit Mark and Michelle, and we're going to be going to that big rally. It's their 30th anniversary, and we'll be, if the weather's permitting, I think he was saying we'll camp. So we'll be camping like in the Swiss Alps, but it's beautiful. I get to drive a real Defender while I'm out there.
We hate you. You know that.
I know. I'll have to do a write-up for you guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
absolutely. Or we can Skype you in. You can give us a report on the podcast.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah. And I can interview. We could
be our foreign correspondent for the day.
But I'm really looking forward to it because it's sort of like what you were saying, John, and some, you know, you might as well live. And if you got the opportunity, you know,
that's
go
right.
travel and see the world.
Exactly. Yeah, you only live once. Yes. Cool. Jeff, anything on your horizon? Should we around?
Well,
that?
I do have I do have the good fortune to be invited to the launch of the Discovery, the press launch of the Discovery in Utah. So I'm looking forward to that in the end of winter, right about the beginning of spring in other parts of the world, not here. I myself am really intrigued with just experiencing more by being in and around my Land Rover. And I say that because my work may not permit me to do travel much beyond the island at times. But when you're in your Land Rover and you're working out of your Land Rover, you rely on it in an intimacy that it doesn't really matter where you go or what you do. It's your Land Rover that's making something possible. And there is a great line in a book that I've just finished reading on a Land Rover adventure. And I don't want to give it away because it's in our next issue, the upcoming issue of the magazine. I've interviewed a couple in England who really defined what a Land Rover ownership is all about. And in this case, it made something possible for them that would not have happened otherwise. And that, in many ways, Laura, your own story right there. You're attending an event in Switzerland by an enthusiast who supports SCAR every year and in turn has created a connection internationally that, you know, you may not have had otherwise. It's an amazing facet of being a Land Rover enthusiast. And I look to, frankly, recognizing more of what my Land Rover makes possible for me, whether it's small and daily in terms of work, or whether it's opportunities to travel and to be around more Land Rover people. The magazine does afford me that, for which I'm hugely thankful. I myself, I'll be honest, I would love to get back to Iceland this year, and hopefully before the weather turns nice over there. There's something about the raw climate of Iceland in a Land Rover that is just spectacular.
So you'd rather go to Iceland than Niceland, huh?
I've worked in Nice once in France for a while. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, I would really very much like to. There is so much Defender opportunity in Iceland, and to experience it at when Iceland is at its most challenging weather is to me the real excitement about it. So I'm hoping to be able to do that and to connect with the Land Rover enthusiasts there and with some of the Defender rental opportunities that exist in Iceland.
I don't want to miss your point, because I think it was excellently done and well said about the Rover community itself. The things that you, as an individual, would probably not be possible were not for your interest and enthusiasm in Land Rovers. I mean, the podcast is a direct result of that and afforded me great opportunities to meet all of you on the show because as a result. And, you know, even the Bells, who came and lived in my house for a week and a half, and I ate like a king. So, yeah, I don't want to miss that. I do have a prediction, kind of in a fun way, for Harold, and that prediction is that he will leave the country in 2017 once my Defender 110 is done, because it'll be done, and then he'll want to escape so I can't call him when there's any problems.
That is the prediction. Those who know me know I am working on a major restoration project for a certain podcast host. So that he can take a trip that he would like to take. And, yeah, that is the threat. Once it's done, you know, the warranty expires at the sidewalk, the door gets shut, the phone gets turned off, and, yeah, I leave the country.
There's no – I can't call his number. It doesn't ring anymore. So those are our predictions and discussions for 2017 and beyond. That was actually really good, guys. I think that was a nice discussion. I didn't know where predictions would take us, but that was pretty cool. So thanks for thanks for all your predictions. If you listeners have your own predictions, to encourage you to share them with us on Facebook or Twitter or send us an email, and we'll talk about them on the show. That is predictions for 2017. Joining us now is Laura Shacklett, all the way from the great state of Texas, to announce on the podcast all the details for SCAR 2017. Laura, thanks for coming back on the show. And for listeners who are unaware, Laura is standing upright she was going to lounge and relax in her couch and talk to us over iPad, but now she's standing up and has the iPad strategically placed, so everything sounds good right now. So we're kind of re-recording this introduction in the hopes that the connection stays stable. So Laura, please, I'll let you have the floor and talk about SCAR.
All right. Well, thank you, John and Harold, for having me back on to talk about SCAR. SCAR, we're holding the 14th annual SCAR on April the 19th through April the 23rd. SCAR is known as the South Central Area Rover Rally, and it's going to be held in Gilmer, Texas at Barnwell Mountain Recreational Area. It's an off-road park in Gilmer, Texas, which is located east of Dallas. Registration is going to open on January 15th, and the registration fees is $130 for Texas Rovers current paid club members, and for non-members, it's $155. And what registration includes for the vehicle and the one driver is the Friday night and Saturday night catered meal. It includes an event goodie bag and the event shirt. It also includes any primitive camping. If you're going to primitive camp and not RV, that it's included in there too as well. And it's 10 free raffle tickets and one main red raffle ticket. And that one red raffle ticket is good for one major prize. It's given away at the Saturday night raffle at the last night. This year we gave away Snowmaster donated a 40-liter fridge. So that was a nice prize for somebody.
Yeah. Are you giving another one of those away this year, perchance?
I don't know. I'm hoping Todd does that again. Yes.
I ask knowingly.
Yeah, well, what we usually try what we usually try to do is make it at a generic prize, you know, like have a, one of the larger prize that's a generic, because you get all these different, you know, you may get a Defender, you may have a Series, an LR3, an LR4, a Disco 1, or a Disco 2, a Range Rover Classic. So it's good to have something generic for the main raffle prize, $100 for two other additional prizes to kind of make that, you know, for the red ticket, you get real excited for that. And then for the passenger fee, that is $40, and that includes Friday night and Saturday night dinner and the event shirt. Children under 12 are free, and that includes their meals but does not include a shirt. And if a parent wants to buy a shirt for their child, we do children's size shirts too. It's an additional $15 that's added to the registration fee. And this event's actually closed to Land Rovers only. So this is pretty much just going to be Land Rovers, attending SCAR, everyone having a great time.
No Toyotas allowed, huh?
No Toyotas allowed, unless you're pulling that. Okay, thank you, Harold. You did remind me that. Let's say you want to pull your Rover because you don't want, if something breaks, then you want to be able to travel back home.
Because you have no sense of humor.
That's right, no sense of humor. Yes, that's right. They're Toyotas. So, well, hi, the Toyota Jamboree only allows Toyotas, only Toyotas on theirs, too. But anyway, you can bring a trailer with your Rover with that. So you can bring a truck with the Rover on that one. There's actually, we have a parking place at the, across from the main pavilion at Barnwell Mountain. That's usually where people park and then unload their Rovers. Barnwell Mountain is a excellent off-road park. It has different challenging trails from 1 to 5 difficulty. So we do have organized trail runs. We have trail leaders. Our bosses who will be organized that, it's going to be Arto and Joey, and they do an excellent job. So you, for those who are beginners, who's just learning, and or for those who don't really know the park, but they still prefer to travel, follow a trail leader. We do have those. Those will start on Thursday afternoon, Friday morning, all day Friday and all day Saturday. Wednesday, the park opens at noon, so you can arrive at noon. We've added that day about 4 years ago because we do get several people that travel either from the up north, Louisiana, just who drive a little further to give them that day to when they drive to go ahead, set up camp, and just go ahead and relax and enjoy the week of wheeling and the camaraderie with fellow Land Rover enthusiasts.
I want to put a word in for SCAR. I'm sure you've talked it right up, Laura, but in just listening to Laura's presentation, there's an unusual amount of humility for a Texan. And you need to know, the world needs to know, this is one of the most intense, most entertaining, and perhaps best off-road situations of any of the Land Rover events in the country. It's amazing how long you can spend on trails of so many different levels of skill. Conditions change with weather, and therefore a trail that you conquered one day could be a trail that conquers you the next. It is the most entertaining event, very well organized, but never feel like you're imposed upon by the organizers of the event. And it draws this eclectic, large group of enthusiasts And I look forward to it every year. There's never a dull moment at it.
So Rover folks, if you don't have a Rover, you are not able to gain entry. But are you able to, say, gain entry to see some of the events that go on, like maybe the Barber Toy event? Do you have spectators in a way that can you bring your Toyota, park it outside, and then still camp? Or is that a possibility? The Barber Toy thing, the Barber Toy event, it kind of extends beyond Rovers in and of itself.
Right. No, actually, it is closed to Rovers only due to the fact the majority of our sponsors are Land Rover related only, especially the dealership, Land Rover Dallas, Frisco, and Austin. They are known as the diamond sponsor. But you can come with if you're a guest of someone's and you do come up with your Toyota, you just can't wheel it. You know, you'd pay the $40 passenger fee, but you have to ride with that and your friend who owns the Rover. Sarah Caldwell, who was the person that helped come up with the idea with the Barber Toy Run, we're expected to expand this right now at this moment. I'm focused on SCAR since I decided the last minute to do SCAR 2017 again. But we do have plans of trying to expand this, and I imagine within the next couple months we will do more. That was one reason we want to have Bill Burke actually do where it's just ladies only, so the ladies feel more comfortable, and do like a recovery. We actually had training with Bill Burke for the trail leaders back in November in Marble Falls at a park called Hidden Falls Adventure Park. And we did that where he got us like in groups of three, and we used two, you know, either a vehicle, and we learned to winch, the proper way to use a winch. So Sarah and I want to incorporate that same type of training for the ladies, for the Barber Toy. So we'll do the trails, but it's going to be more focused, maybe a little bit of training. Nice. As we're getting more, like I said, more ladies are driving Rovers or adding things. But, you know, you can always learn something. I mean, it's amazing the stuff you don't know or the little things that you don't pick up that you go, oh, that's irrelevant. Or the things you do learn by watching someone else that actually does, you know, a winching or recovery, either the right way, the wrong way. And you do realize communication is very important when it comes to this and the safety of yourself and the group around you. So we will probably try to expand this. Sarah and I have been talking. We want to try to come with an official logo for the Barber Toy. That way maybe we can get shirts made for SCAR for the ladies that are participating. And then also maybe some decals. That way we can start expanding it. One of the ideas we had was maybe do like an overland trip, you know, maybe just a short one somewhere in between. She's in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm here in Texas, but try to come up with something that for the ladies, especially for those who can't afford to do the big, you know, the big rallies or the big trips, but try to focus on doing that, making it small and then making it grow, because your confidence can grow. I know mine has from driving a Rover and just learning everything about my Rover, what I'm capable of doing and what my vehicle's doing. And you want to expand that because there's so many women who may not realize what they can do. And if you focus too, even with the younger generation, with the young girls, it'd be nice that we could start, as a lot of the club members' daughters are, you know, coming involved and wanting to drive as they hit 16, this would be a great opportunity to incorporate that too.
I love what you're doing. That's fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
More people driving, more ladies driving. That's wonderful. It's fantastic.
Well, when you bring the women in, then you start to get the next generation, the kids, and it becomes a family thing, and that's how you keep it growing.
Yes, and we do. I've been a member for 10 years, and I've been doing SCAR for about 10 years, and it's amazing now. A lot of the kids that you saw were little by sitting by the campfire. You know, they're turning 16. They're driving. So that idea came to me, what you were saying, Harold, you know, even the boys, you got to incorporate, maybe you do, we add something for the young generation drivers, you know, something so they can feel confident and build up there. And then also you want to expose them more to the outdoors, since so many more kids are, you know, it's being in front of a computer on their cell phone, you know, get out with Mother Nature, enjoy the family and the great outdoors.
Well, right. And modern Rovers are portable computers anymore. There's computers on wheels, right?
That's what they are, yeah. Like, I need to be able to use my like a little iPad type thing on your monitor in your car. Yeah.
Yep, that's right.
Well, the upcoming semi-autonomous Range Rover apps are doing so you can steer around obstacles on your phone. I mean, that's you hand your phone to the kids; they're good with that kind of stuff, right?
Right. That's true. That's true. They are good with that. But well, I think you're losing your. I don't know. I think sometimes technology is a little too much. They start doing that with the vehicles. You're going to kind of lose. Well, one, you lose control, I think. I listened to a radio show yesterday here local. A guy named Ed Wallace does a car show. And they were talking about that, how, you know, we don't want to lose control if they're going to try to make it where you have all these little self-driving cars, you know, and like the self-car, is it going to be able to change the tire for you? You know, stuff like that.
Well, preaching to the choir, sister.
You know. Yeah. Although people can't change tires now, so that's
That should be a requirement for a driver's license.
Yeah, and you know what else? Charging a battery. I work for an oil company here, and we had it was a couple years ago, and we had an intern, and one of my coworkers came in and goes, "Hey, we got an intern, a young guy out of like 20 some years old, did not have a battery charger cables, and didn't even know how to charge the battery. I had the cables,
of course not."
We had to go out there and charge the car for him.
Back to your point about apps being able to drive the car, I do agree with you, man. I love technology, certainly. But what's the point if the car's going to drive itself or having those apps to do it outside of the vehicle? What's the point? Because a lot of it for me driving is challenging myself and doing this thing myself, and being able to get through an obstacle. And if you have a kind of a computer aid, it just kind of takes the fun away, at least for me. So
takes the sport out of it, definitely.
I agree with you, Harold. It takes the sport and the fun and the enthusiasm. You get excited after you
accomplish something.
Cross somewhere. Usually you're screaming to yourself, giving yourself a high five.
Mm-hmm. Actually, the thrill for me comes when John does the driving and doesn't break something.
We've got a couple of those in our club too. You're always glad when it's the last trail and nothing breaks for the usual person.
Mm-hmm. Well, Laura, thank you very much for coming on the show and giving us a rundown and an announcement of SCAR and explaining what SCAR is. What it means.
One last question, if I could. I didn't hear you mention, maybe you did, at the venue there, are there showers and toilets and that sort of thing?
Oh. Yeah, thank you for reminding me that. Yes, Harold, they actually have they do have showers and toilets. They have some that are at the office, and then one that's near the main pavilion. And then also we usually by each campsite we order additional porta potty for that area. We try to make sure we cover enough. The one thing we do too with that is if it's a large group, we make sure we have ladies and men's. We have to sign up for that. One other thing we do too is we actually have a security guard at the main gate. So it's very official. Your name's on there. He verifies that. He greets you and welcomes you. That's
really
been we've done that now, I think, for 5 years.
Does he pat you down and sniff your truck with the dogs and all that kind of stuff?
No, but he will not let any other vehicle that's not a Rover in. Because even though Barnwell states on their website, and that's one reason he's there. We actually had an incident like 6 years ago with some Jeepers. They make sure the gate, he just makes sure no one that's not supposed to come in, that's not on that list. No, we do have a day fee. So if it comes and you decide that last week, the week of SCAR, you want to come, it's a $60 a day feed to wheel. So you can do that too, but then he'll send you to the office and then you just go ahead and register there and pay. And if we have any leftover goodie bags left, then you'll get an event bag with it.
Nice. But,
yeah. So it's been a big hit on that part just because it sponsors too. We have quite a few sponsors who likes that. And we're real good about making sure we've got some sponsor banners on that gate. So if anybody wants to find out more about SCAR, you can visit www.texasrovers.com. We have a SCAR forum, and then we also have a menu bar, which will have more detailed information on SCAR. If you're one of those that's a social media, we do have a Facebook page, SCAR, and you can ask to be included on that page. It's a closed group, but we will I'll accept you there. If you have any questions, you can contact me at SCAR, SCARR, @texasrovers.org.
And what are the dates again?
The date is April the 19th through April the 23rd. And I believe Jeff with Rovers North is trying to come again. He likes coming to SCAR.
Yeah. If someone were to, say, fly in, what would be the nearest airport?
The nearest airport would be DFW. We do actually get a few, like Jeff will fly in. We've had a few other sponsors that fly in, and you'll fly into DFW.
But then they'd need to rent a Land Rover to get through the gate, huh?
No, you can have a little car for that and drive through. We'll let you in for that because your name would be listed on there.
Okay, so if your name's on the list, you're getting in no matter what. Okay.
Right, yeah. Yeah, Jeff gets in. We usually organize a ride for Jeff.
Well, Jeff gets a pass no matter what.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
So you're saying if I know someone and they might be able to smuggle me in somehow, huh?
Yes. Well, no, we'd love for you to come out and you and Harold. You could come and do your podcast.
I'm seriously, that's why I asked about what was the nearest airport.
Yeah, you know where we're headed.
And I mean, if we need to make arrangements, we can try to do that and get you guys there.
All right.
But yeah, no, we'd love to have you guys there. You can set up at the main pavilion too for your podcast.
We
don't need much, trust me.
Okay. Well, I'm just letting you know there is electricity there and there's Wi-Fi at the office. I do know that much. So
excellent. We'll talk about this offline, but wonderful.
I just was considering
the subject. That's why I asked about the nearest airport.
No, see, and then you could bring your decals and put them in the goodie bags. Mm-hmm. And then we're promoting you, Center Steer.
Indeed. Oh, good. Yeah, good, good, good. Okay, all good stuff.
And then we can announce you on the website that you're going to be there.
Oh, no. What have I got myself into?
Yeah, careful what we're stepping into here, John.
I like the idea.
I like cross promotion, but yeah, commitments are difficult.
Yeah, that's true.
We'll talk about it. We'll figure something out.
Yeah, I mean, but it's going to be a well-organized, exciting event, different activities for just anybody. And then those who just like to socialize and sit by a campfire, you know, you've got that too.
That's me.
It sounds like you've done your homework and you've got all the details sorted out.
Well, when you've done it 8 years, you kind of do that. Then you just have to try to keep it the way it is. I mean, it was like, how do I keep it going from like what we did this year? We were able to step it up a lot just with acknowledging sponsors in a lot better way and the event bag. So you're always having to rethink and try to be one step ahead.
Well, thanks again, Laura, for coming on the show and announcing SCAR of 2017 for us on the podcast. And we'll talk. Maybe the podcast will show up at SCAR. That could be pretty cool. So thanks again, Laura.
Thank you.
And that's the show for December 2016. This is the Center Steer podcast. I want to thank all our contributors and our guests this month. Morgan, who gave us the Heritage segment, was unable to be with us on the show today, but we previously recorded that and inserted it into the show.
He's off doing important things somewhere.
And hopefully next month we'll get his Disco 2 update because we were going to do that this month. And I also want to thank Harold for joining us on the show and giving us his insight.
Or whatever you want to call it.
And thanks to Laura from Texas Rovers for discussing and announcing. Thanks for giving us the exclusive. Even if it isn't, I'm calling it an exclusive, Laura, on SCAR 2017.
The scoop.
Well, thank you so much for having me and giving me this the club an opportunity to talk about SCAR. And hopefully you'll be able to make it out to SCAR. We'd love to have you. And Harold, too, if possible, and just show our Southern hospitality to both of y'all for always having a great podcast and promoting the Land Rover Heritage and the Land Rover Clubs of the United States.
I thank you, and I'm strongly leaning towards being there. And also, thank you to our other guest, Jeff Aronson, Rovers Magazine. Thanks again, Jeff, for coming on and giving us your insight.
Thank you very much, John. Thanks for the opportunity and allowing me to be guest. I also just want to take a moment. When we talked about predictions for 2017, it's a perfect time to reflect upon what you've accomplished as our host and moderator. I'm sure I have no real idea about the amount of time it takes pre-production and post-production to make the podcast such a fabulous resource for Land Rover enthusiasts around the world. But I do know that you come up with these tremendous opportunities month after month after month, and I really commend you for doing it. and look forward to just a great 2017 series of podcasts on the Center Steer.
You're too kind. Thank you. That is, in fact, truly the podcast for this month. I hope you enjoyed the show, and thank you for listening. I remind you to visit our website for past shows and show notes. You can connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Give us your feedback on the shows. Give us your suggestions on topics, or you know, send us a photo of your truck in all its holiday glory. I'm sure I stick a wreath on the front of my 109 for the month of December, so man, I should push that picture out. So, yeah, if you do that, send us a picture of that. You can also directly support the show on our Patreon account, which is Patreon, patreon.com/centersteer. If you'd like to be a sponsor of the show, send me an email. Until next time, I ask you to share the show with one other Land Rover fan. Thanks for listening. Wave as we pass by.
Also, a shout out to the One True Pass for his production support.
Anybody want to comment? Say, John, no, you're an idiot.
I'm surprised Jeff didn't jump in. This is usually his wheelhouse.
All right, then I will.